I thought it would be helpful. I think the subject of thermal history is a bit disorienting at first. I thought it would be helpful to just kind of come in and draw like a roadmap of the sequence of events that we're going to be talking about. And I'm just going to walk through it without really deriving anything. And then the purpose of the lectures, of course, is to show you why all these things happen. Got here a little early and put it on the board. If I'd known there was an Easter egg hunt earlier for that. So I want to start at the top. I put the events in reverse chronological order. I've divided the universe into like two components. Plasma that consists of some ensemble of species that are in thermal equilibrium. And I'm just defining a plasma informally as a set of species whose interaction rate is like number of interactions per particle per unit time. Is large compared to the Hubble expansion rate, so that the plasma can reach thermal equilibrium in one doubling time of the universe and stay in thermal equilibrium as the universe expands. And then one or more decoupled species, which are species whose interaction rate is slow compared to the expansion of the universe. And they would just free stream on geodesics and not see the other particles, except gravitationally. So according to that classification, today, there are no species in a plasma state. Everything is decoupled. And if we run back the clock to the universe gets hotter until it reaches a temperature of around 3000 Kelvin or 0.1 eV, that'll be the first thermal event that I'll talk about, which is recombination, which is a misnomer. It's the first time in the universe's history when protons and electrons combine to form neutral hydrogen. And it just refers to a time when the universe cooled enough that the favored thermodynamic state is no longer a plasma of ionized protons and electrons, but it's thermodynamically favored for those species to bind into neutral hydrogen. And then when that happens, the universe becomes transparent. So the photons aren't really doing much during this time, but after that point, they start free streaming. And so I've classified them as decoupled particles. I haven't really talked about helium yet, but it behaves similarly to hydrogen. About 25% of the universe's mass turns out to be in helium and the other 75% in hydrogen. And the binding energy of helium is higher. So it recombines earlier in the universe's evolution when the temperature is higher. Helium recombination happens at a temperature of around 1 eV. Before that time, the universe is a plasma of doubly ionized helium, some protons, or ionized hydrogen, if you like, and some electrons and photons. And this whole time, the neutrinos and the dark matter haven't really been doing anything except for moving on geodesics and interacting gravitationally. Just for the sake of completeness, helium recombination is really two thermal events, one where the first electron binds and another one where the second electron binds. And then not much happens for a long time. There's this big separation of energy scales between the energy scales of chemistry, which are around 1 eV, and the energy scales of nuclear physics, which are around an MeV. That's why a nuclear bomb is like a million times more powerful than a stick of dynamite. Should find a more less morbid analogy. And then several things happen almost at once. The latest thing to happen is BBN, or Big Bang Nucleosynthesis, that looks a lot like hydrogen recombination, where protons and electrons combine to form neutral hydrogen. Only at BBN, the recombination event is protons and neutrons combining to form atomic nuclei. Almost all the neutrons just end up in helium. That's where the 25% of the universe by mass that's helium comes from. With a small fraction of neutrons, like on the order of 10 to the minus 4, and a few other nuclei, deuterium and lithium and helium-3. So BBN used to be kind of you took cosmology like 40 years ago, then BBN would just be sort of like the observational centerpiece of the class, since you would constrain cosmological parameters by predicting abundances of things like deuterium in the universe from BBN. And then there's some interesting consistency checks, and you get to constrain some cosmological parameters. But nowadays, BBN has kind of fallen by the wayside since it's super complicated and observationally very tricky. It's fraught with systematics. And the CMB just turns out to be a more powerful way to constrain the same parameter. So I won't talk about BBN much, but it is really fun to study because you see where all the elements in the universe are originally formed. Around the same time, when the temperature of the universe is the rest mass of the electron, or 0.5 MeV, positrons and electrons are annihilating. So above that temperature, there's lots of energy around to pair produce positrons and electrons out of vacuum. But below that temperature, they find each other and annihilate, and then the recombination of, or the pair formation of positrons and electrons is exponentially suppressed. So above that temperature, you have a bunch of positrons in the plasma, but below that temperature, they've mostly annihilated. This type of annihilation event is frequent in the history of the universe, especially at higher energies. And the third thing that happens at the MeV scale is neutrino decoupling, where it turns out that the neutrino interaction rate with the plasma turns out to be a rapidly decreasing function of time. So that at early times, the neutrinos are thermally coupled. We'll do this calculation hopefully today. And then at late times, the neutrinos are decoupled from the plasma. The average number of interactions of a neutrino with anything else in the universe for the entire lifetime of the universe is much less than one. And so the neutrinos just start free streaming on geodesics. If we continue to go back in time and increase the energy from there, then nothing much happens for a while, for another factor of 100 or so in energy. And then you get to the GeV scale, where there are tons of annihilation events. The standard model has a lot of particles at around 100 MeV. First is the muon, which is whose mass is almost exactly 100 MeV. And then next is the pion, and so on. And so just as at a temperature of 0.5 MeV, you start to see positrons produced. You would start to see all of the standard model particles get produced. So there's just lots more standard model annihilation events here that I didn't attempt to work out in detail. Once you get above the electroweak scale at around 100 GeV or so, you've run out of standard model particles to produce in the plasma. So I've just written SM here for a huge number of standard model particles. At least in one popular model of dark matter formation, the thermal WIMP scenario, the dark matter finally came into thermal equilibrium with the rest of the plasma at around 300 GeV. There are many ideas for where dark matter may have come from, and this thermal relic scenario is just one of several, but it's the one that I'll focus on. And I'll justify where this estimate of 300 GeV came from. So dark matter decoupling in a scenario where dark matter is a thermal relic, like neutrinos, would look a lot like neutrino decoupling, just at much higher energy. So that's one general set of comments. The other general comment I want to make is that today I'm going to partially be reviewing what Neil talked about, but fleshing it out in a bit more detail, and partially talking about some new stuff. If you want to follow this sequence of events, the equations of motion that you need to solve would look something like this. So that at all times, the thermal state of the universe is described by some set of functions, which are the mean occupation number, or expected number of particles, can be either, that has to be between 0 and 1 for a fermion, but could be anything for a boson. Where I here indexes a species, which could be any of the particles in this history. And Q indexes a momentum. These functions, which would fully describe the thermal state of the universe, satisfy an equation of motion, which is called the Boltzmann equation. And it looks something like this. So you'll see different versions of this with different generalities. So I've assumed that F does not depend on spatial position. Otherwise, there would be more terms here. I'm ignoring perturbations for now, or spatial perturbations, I mean. And then I've also assumed by rotational symmetry that the occupation number only depends on the magnitude of Q and not its direction. So there's some equation like this where C of F is called the collision term. And it's just, it's always something horrible, which is, would take a long time to even write on the blackboard and is hard to make much progress with analytically. Like if you really want to integrate this equation in detail, it really has to be done on the computer and with like big computer programs. Just for fun, before the lecture, I tried to work out what this collision term would look like just for like the simplest field theory, like a lambda phi to the fourth theory. And I got stuck. It was a long calculation. In practice, you know, we don't really ever write this equation down. We just try to deduce what's going to happen based on like a patchwork of approximations. And so the most important principle is that the evolution of these functions is simple in two limits. Either if C of F is small, meaning that a species is decoupled, or if C of F is large. Decoupled just means that the particles move on geodesics without new particles being created or destroyed. Or if CF is large, in which case the collisions will thermalize the distribution you'll get some sort of thermal probability distribution that keeps up with the expansion of the universe. Just to kind of describe what this collision term might look like pictorially, if I have some process that takes two particles and particles one and two and converts them to particles three and four, then that would show up on the right-hand side of these equations as like a term in the equation of motion for species one. It looks like some integral which is proportional to the amount of species two. And whose rate is like the quantum mechanical rate, or going from 1, 2 to 3, 4. That sounds simple, but the reason that it's horrible is that all the kinematic factors, like the phase space integrals, are kind of confusing. And then whenever you have a quantum mechanical process like this, you can always permute the legs around so that you can take 3 and 4 and run the diagram backwards and get 1 and 2. So for consistency, this term needs to come with a bunch more terms related to it by permutation symmetry. Okay. Well, avoid reordering my beautiful table. I'll switch to this board. So let's start by talking about a decoupled species. I think Neil wrote down the Boltzmann equation, or or some variant of it, I think, where I think in Neil's version, like this Q depended on direction. I don't think Neil wrote down the solution in the case where there are no collisions. So imagine that I have, of course, one thing I didn't say explicitly is that at any time in the universe's history, or at most times in the universe's history, we'll be able to identify some set of particles which are decoupled and some set of particles which are thermal. But then, you know, as different interaction rates cross over the Hubble expansion rate, then those classifications will change, and those are the events in this history. So if a species is decoupled, then its evolution can be considered independently of what the other species are doing. So imagine that I have this equation of motion for a function of two variables, q and t, with some initial conditions. Just let those be general. I'll assume that at some initial time, it'll be convenient to use, instead of t as the time coordinate, to use the scale factor a. Let's just assume that I'm given the function as a function of q at some initial time a zero. And let's try to guess the solution based on our knowledge of FRW geodesics. After all, what should happen physically is that each particle just free streams on an FRW geodesic, and then verify that it satisfies the equation. So you might then guess that for an FRW geodesic, remember that we showed that the momentum always evolves as the scale factor to the minus one. And then you might guess that if I'm counting particles at some later scale factor A, that I would just blue shift them back to the time A zero. I would look at momentum A over A zero times Q. And then just count the number of particles at that momentum in the past. And that does turn out to be true. Easy to check. I'll just write that it's straightforward to check. That it solves equation star. So the left-hand side of Boltzmann's equation, I just wrote it down without talking about where this combination of terms is coming from, but it's really encoding our knowledge about the behavior of FRW geodesics. Yeah. And in the opposite limit, we have a thermal species, which Neil talked about a lot and built up a lot of useful formulas. So a species is thermal. If its mode function is the following Q dependence. This equation introduces several notational conventions. One is that the symbol E sub Q always stands for the energy of a particle at momentum Q, where M is the rest mass of the particle I. And whenever I write an equation with plus minus notation. I always mean that the upper sign is a boson and the lower sign is a fermion. And in this equation, the content of this equation is really a statement about Q dependence. The temperature T and the chemical potential mu can evolve depend on time. Often chemical potentials are zero. If you have enough interactions, then chemical potentials are equal to zero, where enough means that there are no conserved quantum numbers. You can like get from any multiparticle state to any other multiparticle state by some sequence of interactions. If you do have conserved quantum numbers, like electric charge or baryon number or something like that, then you'll generally have one chemical potential for each conserved quantity. And the chemical potentials are in there to give the Boltzmann distribution enough freedom to match the total baryon number of the universe or the total electric charge of the universe. I won't do an example today of a situation where chemical potentials are important, but I'll get to it eventually when we talk about recombination. I should say that we'll be able to talk about, in this class I'm going to talk about the history of the universe using like Boltzmann equation light. I'll write the equation down and then I'll explain that I'll say that you're usually in one of these two regimes. I'll try to cover the thermal history with some patchwork of approximations where at each time in the thermal history, some of the particles are thermal and others are decoupled. And the only thermal event on this list that I just won't be able to talk about is BBN. BBN is just a really out of equilibrium series of events where there were a bunch of different processes with similar rates that are all competing with each other. So it's not really possible to treat BBN as in this approximation. But the other events on the list we can work through. Okay. Then one more general principle, which I said out loud, but I'll write down, is that species is decoupled if gamma is small compared to H and thermal gamma is large compared to H, where gamma is the number of interactions per particle per unit time. Okay. I want to review, Neil mostly talked about this, but I want to just go through it briefly, mainly because most of the homework problems touch on it in some way. The first event on this list that I want to talk about is E plus E minus annihilation. So for now, I'd like to forget what the other particles are doing, namely the neutrino and the dark matter, which are kind of spectators on this process.
Yes? Here for the gamma, I'm thinking of the units in gamma and H, and how are they comparable? H reading as interactions divided by particle by time.
Well, yeah, they both have units of inverse time. H, remember, is the fractional increase in scale factor per unit time. And this is really like this, it's a dimensionless numerator, and The particle in the denominator is also dimensionless. It's like, it's not like number density.
Okay.
It, just if you follow one particle around, how many times does it interact? Okay. The annihilation event can be understood just purely by assuming that all particles stay in thermal equilibrium. So just the thermal plasma, if you start with a thermal plasma that contains positrons, electrons, and photons, and then let it cool with the expansion of the universe, then it will turn out to be true that the positrons and the electrons annihilate, and you're left behind with only photons. That works out as follows. So for a thermal species with zero chemical potential, let me assume at first that all chemical potentials are zero, and then I'll come back and revisit that assumption at the end. So for a thermal species with mu equals zero, the first thing I want to do is write down the energy density. Okay. So this is a function of the particle's mass and the temperature. Maybe I'll put the mass in here on the left hand side. Which is no problem to compute numerically. It just has the unfortunate property that the integral can't be done analytically, so you have to carry around this cumbersome expression. But it does have simple limits in the case of a relativistic. It does have simple relativistic and non-relativistic limits. The relativistic means that the temperature is much greater than the mass, and the non-relativistic is much less than the mass. And in the relativistic case, it's, I forgot to say that the g here is the number of spin states of the particle, like two for the photon, or two for a spin one-half fermion, but like one for a scalar. Energy density is slightly different for a boson or a fermion. It's for the boson, it's the number of spin states times pi squared over 30 times t to the fourth. Generalizing the familiar blackbody law from statistical mechanics, where for photons, where the numerical prefactor is pi squared over 15. And then for a fermion, almost the same thing, but there's a factor of 7/8. And then for a non-relativistic particle, then this energy density is exponentially suppressed. As you can see, since you'd have a factor of e to the m over t in the denominator. So if t is much smaller than m, you have something exponentially large in the denominator. And the answer turns out to be the same for both both fermions and bosons. And so just as a bit of notation, this is sometimes written as sort of convenient to think about it this way, especially if you're drawing pictures. So this is just a definition. The function g star of t is defined to be the total energy density of the universe divided by t to the fourth with this factor of pi squared over 30. The convenient definition, because it's easy to remember that this quantity g star, or sometimes it's called like the effective number of species, where effective means effective in determining the energy density, is obtained by adding up the spin degrees of freedom of each boson, each relativistic boson. With a factor of 7/8 for fermions. And a zero, or it would even be more accurate, all right, exponentially suppressed. Or for any non-relativistic particle, whose rest mass is above the temperature. Okay, so this is already enough machinery. I do want to emphasize that these expressions just come out of expanding that integral in the high t and low t limits. And so this is already enough information to conclude that e plus e minus annihilation happens. I'm going to plot the energy density as a function of time, except it's more convenient. Make this plot really long. Except for it's more convenient to plot g star instead of rho. So you should just remember that I'm just plotting the energy density, but in some funny units where I've scaled out the t to the fourth and then also put in a factor 30 over pi squared. What would happen is the energy density would look something like this. Where I've added up contributions with a feature at around 0.5 MeV, the mass of the electron. Where I've just sort of added up in this plot contributions from the photon. With g star equals 2. And then the electrons and positrons, which, according to my expression here for g star, start out at 7/2 and then exponentially decay. You get the total, where g star starts out at 11/2 and ends up at 2. Oh my goodness, mangled this. And so this type of annihilation event, is kind of a blueprint for what's happening at other times in the universe where the temperature crosses the rest mass of particles. The electron is the lightest particle in the standard model, so or at least besides the neutrino, which is decoupled at this point. There are no more annihilation events between here and today. But if I look further back at higher temperatures, I labeled the axis T for temperature, but I was imagining evolving in time from left to right, so low temperatures on the right and high temperatures on the left. And if you kept going back, you would find that at around 100 MeV, you would suddenly run into a bunch more particles like muons and pions, and it would start to come up. Sort of roughly remember what this looks like. You might think that this the behavior at these high energies just has no observable consequences. But it's convenient to know that it, you know, G star is some value like around 10 for this big interval. And then around 100 MeV, it comes up. I'll try to draw what I remember it looking like. It does one of these, and then it jumps up really fast. And then it kind of increases a little bit and stabilizes at around 100 GeV. One thing that's really useful to know is that it ends up at a value of around 100, I think 106.75, if I remember correctly, is the G star of the entire standard model. Like if you add up all the degrees of freedom in the standard model, like the gluons and the quarks and so on, with a factor of 7/8 for every fermion, then you end up with this value. And there's a big jump here at a few hundred MeV from the QCD phase transition, where instead of nucleons, you have a plasma composed of gluons and quarks, and a lot more degrees of freedom become available. Okay. I'll leave this plot up too, so I guess I'll... Now, I'm going to explain why this evolution of G star actually has observable consequences. Like, it's what this is all happening at energies much higher than the temperature of the universe when the CMB is formed, or when galaxies are formed, or any of the things that we can directly observe. It takes a little while to explain. And the pace that I'm going at compared to the pace I thought I would go at is like differ by like a factor of 3. Am I going
Maybe you're teaching in a spaceship.
Sorry?
You might be teaching in a spaceship.
That's probably it. I didn't think of that. Okay. Oh yeah, right. Another really important thing that I failed to mention. So where's my plot? Oh yeah, okay. So one problem with this plot, that the dashed curve is showing the E plus E minus abundance. Let me bring it back down. Okay, so one thing I didn't mention is where the 7/2 comes from. That's because there's a factor of 2 because I'm counting both E plus and E minus. And then another factor of 2 because the electron is spin 1/2. I'm 7/8 because the electron is a fermion. And then the 2 here is just because the photon has 2 degrees of freedom, and it's a boson. So this prediction has a big problem. Namely, it predicts that the electrons and the positrons would have completely annihilated, and there would be nothing left in the universe today besides photons. Let me just mention that what actually happens is that by the time you get to this point, there is a conserved quantum number, namely electric charge. It's not the case that the number of electrons and positrons is the same. Rather, there's some small imbalance. The number of electrons is larger than the number of positrons by something like 10 to the minus 8. I'm sorry, it's more like 10 to the minus 9, I think. And so What happens is that at first that small imbalance or asymmetry is negligible, but then when you get to a small enough abundance, it becomes large. And then the number of, eventually there aren't any positrons around to annihilate the small, the 1/1,000,000,000th of the electrons that have survived. So you end up with some small number of electrons, which is whose contribution to the energy density is down by a factor of like 10 to the minus 9 compared to the photons. The positrons do exponentially annihilate. So the number of electrons is tiny at this time in the universe's evolution, or at least as a fraction of the energy density is tiny. But because they're non-relativistic, their contribution to the energy density scales as a to the minus 3, whereas the photon scales a to the minus 4. So if we wait until the universe has expanded by another factor of 10 to the 9, then the electrons will come back. And that is the situation today. We've just waited long enough that electrons are around in great abundance and make a larger contribution to the energy density than photons. The origin of this asymmetry, it's called the baryon asymmetry because the same asymmetry exists in the ratio of like protons to antiprotons in order to keep the universe electrically neutral. Is an unsolved problem in theoretical physics. At some high energy, presumably there was some process that violated baryon conservation that imprinted this small amount of baryon asymmetry on the universe. I'm actually not an expert in this. I just know a little bit about it from going to random talks. But my understanding is that it's still an unsolved problem whether the standard model contains a mechanism for producing the baryon asymmetry or whether you need beyond standard model physics. Not really the sort of thing that I think about because I'm more of a data analyst and computational person. This isn't the sort of thing where getting more data would be helpful. Like we know that it's just a pure theory problem. We know the asymmetry exists. Otherwise, none of us would be around to talk about baryon asymmetry. We know what value it has by comparing the number of CMB photons to the number of electrons in the universe today. Now it's just a puzzle in theoretical physics to figure out where it came from. Okay, that's all I wanted to add. Okay. Now there's just one more ingredient here that I want to talk about, which is that just from considerations of thermal equilibrium with no knowledge of the no detailed knowledge of the underlying processes, you can predict this whole evolution precisely if you're using temperature as the clock. You know, you have these equations that for any value of the temperature will tell you the energy density of every species in the universe. But the one thing that doesn't quite follow just from this expression for rho is the if I wanted to change the x-axis to be scale factor instead of temperature. So the next thing to work out is the temperature dependence on the scale factor. Neil went through this. So I just want to write it down, I think. So the A dependence of T. It's determined by entropy conservation. Little s a cubed should be a constant, where the quantity little s is defined for any collection of thermal species. Like this, it's the energy density or FRW energy density plus the FRW pressure over temperature and interpret it as the entropy density, entropy per physical volume, not co-moving volume. So there's a few perspectives on this. So I guess I want to review it a little bit because the homework problems are so centered on this. So the argument that Neil gave was thermodynamic. So if you believe statistical mechanics, and we're assuming a collection of thermal particles so that they stay in thermal equilibrium as the universe expands, then you would predict that there is a notion of entropy which satisfies the first law. If you do some algebra, then you can identify big S equals little s times A cubed as the entropy. And one little thing that I want to write down here is that there's a statement that I called the key lemma. It says that turns out the algebra works out quite nicely if you know that the temperature derivative of the pressure is equal to rho plus P over T, where I realized I forgot to write down the pressure. So I wrote down the FRW energy density as an integral. And very similarly, the pressure can be written down. The energy density is quite intuitive. I'm just counting particles and assigning energy E to each particle. The pressure is less intuitive. I assign Q squared over E to each particle. So I think the statement that in GR, each particle a particle of momentum Q and energy E contributes Q squared over 3E to the pressure is non-obvious, but it follows from a GR argument, writing down the stress energy tensor as Neil did. A second argument So if you don't like thermodynamics, then you can conclude that this quantity is constant purely from the equations of motion. So I wrote the calculation down in my notes, but I think I'm going slower than I thought. I'll skip it. So you can show this using not a long calculation. So if you mechanically differentiate this and then simplify using the using two equations, the continuity equation, one of the terms that you get will have rho dot in it. You can write that as VH times rho plus P. And then there's also a term with P dot in it. And so you use a statement that I called the key lemma to write P dot as the temperature derivative of P times T dot. And write that as rho plus P over T times T dot. Then you get a bunch of magic cancellations and you end up getting zero. I like this argument because it's super rigorous, just from the assumption that particles are thermal, so that their FRW pressure and energy density are given by these integrals, plus the continuity equation. Then You can show that the quantity, this quantity S times A cubed is conserved. So that's has the advantage of being really rigorous, but the disadvantage that it looks like an algebraic accident. You kind of discover the entropy by accident. And then finally, there's a third argument. I get to experience the joy of this calculation on the problem set. Which is based on counting states. So, so usually in statistical physics, there's like two ways of getting at the entropy. You can try to use thermodynamic arguments to infer the right notion of entropy. Like you can write down an equation for ds and then try to integrate it. And the other thing you can do is like a microscopic calculation of the entropy. Where I have some situation where I have a probability distribution of states. And always define the entropy by summing over states, where P is the probability of each state. So this is sum over states S. In this situation where I'm assuming that I have a bunch of thermal particles, each of which has a thermal and definite probability distribution, it's possible to do the sum and after some algebra arrive at this expression. So that's three ways of getting at this conservation law, which is maybe two more than we need, but I like it. And I just enjoy it in physics when there's like apparently different ways of calculating the same thing and ending up with the same answer. Okay. So now that we know that the entropy density always goes as 1 over a cubed, and that we know how to compute it, it's just rho plus p over t, where rho and p are the integrals that I wrote down before. So this is a new function of t, so similar to rho of t, and we can do the same thing, expand it. Expand the integrals in the relativistic and non-relativistic limits. You get almost the same thing as for rho. It goes as t cubed instead of t to the fourth, and the prefactor is different. There's still a factor of 7/8 for a fermion. As for rho, it's sort of convenient to think about, instead of thinking about S, since S it has this factor of t cubed and then some, you're summing over spin degrees of freedom, to replace S by this quantity g star S. G star S is almost the same thing as S. Okay. You compare, you guys probably can't see this because it's behind the podium. Let me raise the board. In the top plot, I plotted G star versus temperature to give a sense for how the energy density of the universe evolved. If I were to make the same plot for G star S, it would look like visually indistinguishable from the plot of G star. But there would just be small differences in the region, in the regions where it's evolving. G star S, if you look at the integrals, it's not exactly the same function as G star. But it does have the same limits in all three of these cases. For a relativistic boson, it's g. For a non-relativistic, 7/8 g. And in the non-relativistic case, it's exponentially suppressed. But the details of the exponential suppression and what happens in between are a little different. It's easy to like mix them up, and sometimes I'll say I'll write g star instead of g star s. But technically, they're different functions of temperature. Okay. So that's about time for today. This was ended up being mostly a review of what Neil did, but hopefully it was helpful. Next time I'll come back and talk about more events on the list. Are there any questions before we break? Okay, we'll see you tomorrow.